Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Coogan Chronicles. It's just AJ this week. I'm holding the whole fort down. This is a podcast where two former... I'm kidding. Chris is here, too.
Psych! I'm in, guys. I'm in. You think we let AJ do this on his own? Yeah, right.
Would never happen. But the rest is true. This is a show about two former kid actors...
who talk to other former kid actors...
about growing up in the biz. That's what we do, week in and week out. It never gets old. There's always something new and fresh to talk about, folks.
There is. In fact, this week, it's real fresh. I think it's real new. I think our episode with our bud Charlie Talbert is really – it hits a really interesting point, folks. I think we go to a place in this interview that I don't think we've touched on too much in depth so far within all of our interviews. And that, I think, is this – you know, the really heavy side of what life can be like as an adult if you were a former kid actor. And I think what sometimes the pitfalls, as AJ calls them, that, you know, that set kids
like
up.
Like a lot of people would call them pitfalls. Term.
All right. Anyway, so the exclusive term pitfalls that AJ copyrighted that we use on this show. Pitfalls. That's the way I put it. I mean, I just call it just like harsh reality smacking you in the gut. You know, it's like I think that's what happens, you know. But we go to this, you know, Charlie really opened up with us and talked with us about, you know, some heavy stuff he's experienced. And so it's a subject matter that I think if you're a bit sensitive to some heavy subject matter, if you're looking purely for like, I don't know, funny jokes about what it was like to be on a Disney set. I don't know if this is your episode. You know, just put him throw that out there now.
No, this is definitely not that.
And Charlie's hysterically funny and he's really charismatic and he tells us some really good stories too. But there is a side of this that does get, dark.
It's a little heavier. A heavier episode.
It is. And it speaks to probably something I've been waiting and wanting to talk about for a long time, which I will... just start to get to, I think we'll start to chip away at it now, which is the idea that at a certain point that for a kid, here's the setup for this. So I share a very similar childhood to Charlie, which is both of us have experienced a decent amount of trauma in our childhoods and a chaotic lifestyle, chaotic family lifestyle, dysfunctional family life. And I think what happens to former kid actors, if you come from that environment, if that's your world, when you start to become a professional actor and you get onto sets, the workplace becomes your safe place, becomes your safe environment. And you would hope, right, that any kid that goes through, that is going through trauma in their lives and is experiencing abuse or of any kind, that they would find a safe place in their life, whether that is school or whether that's with good friends or another family member, sports, something, right? You know, an activity. So in one way, it's really easy to say, hey, that's, you know, well, if you found a safe place in being an actor and working, great. But I think what it actually does is it sets up kids as they become adults to go through an even further amount of hardship, I guess you can say.
Well, I was just going to ask, Chris, which I think you're going to get to now, what was that transition like for you as you became an adult? And what did you expect sets to continue to give you? So you're getting this escape as a kid, a safe place to go to as a kid. But then when you're an adult and you're creating your own safe space for yourself outside of work, what is your relationship to being on set like? And how is that potentially troublesome or not so great?
Well, it's all completely troublesome and not so great because here's the really harsh reality. I just think here's the harsh reality to the entertainment industry in general, which is the entertainment industry does not coddle people. It's not like a particularly kind or thoughtful place. It is 90% of the time, it is strictly business. And it is a business that really foregoes a lot of people's emotions. It is not too terribly kind. And it does not care much for how people are feeling majority of the time. It is capitalism at its best. I mean, it is literally no different than any other type of business. Granted, like 10% of the time, there are these complete artistic endeavors and there are wonderful people that get to work and get to provide a workspace for everyone to be fully artistically fulfilled and giving and can be that place that every person that I think gets into the entertainment industry, whether it's on in front of the camera or behind it or any capacity, is sort of aspiring or dreaming of or would be idealistic about, you know, would think like, oh, that's what I would ultimately want. There is that does exist. But honestly, very rare, very rarely does it exist, and not so often. And to get to that, anyway, that's the setup to say, I really do think that what happens then is, like, what I experienced was when my safe place was my work life, when that was like my consistency and the place where I looked for validation and I looked for self-worth and I looked for emotional stability and where I looked for love and honesty and thoughtfulness and, you know, the things you look for in your family. I was repeatedly hurt and let down and disappointed and repeatedly put myself in a position with those expectations to get crushed, you know, quite honestly. It took me years and years to really solidify and figure out that it is never going to give me that. It just won't. And it really doesn't give anyone that, is what I came to realize. And that no one's place, they shouldn't be plugging into that like it. And you know, and I'm talking, you know, actors and directors and writers I've worked with that are at the top of the game, you know, the most lauded, respected people, or people that are just getting into it and you know, or just spent a god awful amount of money on college to study something and are getting in the biz and they got everything behind them and they just went on this big thing and now they accomplished they got the degree and they're in there. Anybody on any level, I think, experiences the same thing, you know?
Do you think that that's different for the entertainment industry than other industries?
I think, to be honest, that this is just my opinion, so I really don't know. I think that a majority of people do have a much different expectation of the entertainment industry than other industries, because I think on the surface, it really truly does look a certain way. It absolutely does. Maybe with the advent of social media and the way things have been the last few years, where there's a lot of voice to people's struggles and what would have been considered minor discretions in the past, or things that were forgivable or forgotten about or swept under the rug. I think there's a lot of things that are able to get under the microscope. And that's probably one of them, a facet of like how harsh the entertainment industry can be. But I don't think anybody actually, from the outside, I don't think many people actually understand that. I really don't. I think a majority of the time it feels like, you know, you see a lot of the success stories and you see the grind, and then that's really it. And I don't think many people see behind the curtain in that way. And I think that why I bring this up in this regard is because I think it's one thing if you're an adult and you've got adult expectations of what you think being an actor is going to be like, or being part of the entertainment industry is going to be like. It's another thing if you were a kid doing that for a long time. And I think for myself, and I think for someone like Charlie and maybe our other guest, Stephen Anthony Lawrence, and I'm sure a lot of future guests will talk to, when your work life became that stable environment for you and where you drew so much of your inner safety and sense of self from, I mean, you get knocked the fuck out when you're an adult and you're just an adult part of the entertainment industry. You know, you really do. And I found that in many ways, you know. I found it also in, like, you know, relationships, you know, people, if you're working in a business, I mean, everybody knows, like, there's always a coworker where you're like, you're a little needy. You're like, you don't have to.
Were you the needy? So you're the needy coworker.
No, I wasn't the needy coworker. I think what happened is inside, I think the first amount of trouble I had, and this is where I say, guys, we're just hinting at this conversation. I think it's going to be a long ongoing.
We were kidding. But there's no Charlie episode. This is the episode where Chris gets to talk about all of this
exactly.
Stuff.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. But no, I think this is the first thing I could drop about it, which is the good example of all of this, which was all of a sudden I'm an adult and I started to realize, like, oh, no one's as nice to me as they were. Like, they're not as, like,
at some point the kid gloves come off at a certain point and you're not ready for it. Nobody tells you.
Yeah,
okay,
nobody
remember
says
how,
like,
we treated you as a kid. We're not doing that anymore.
That's not exactly. You're now like 17. You're an adult. You don't need us to sit there and go on like, hey, that was great. That was great. Every single time you do something, we don't need it anymore. You know, there's that, or there's that, you know, you start to meet new people and the expectations of you are the same expectations they would put on an adult that is not in search of what you might be in search of, you know, that is not sitting there trying to plug into the job or the result of a possible job in a way that is all their self-worth is coming from that possibility and all of their value of oneself and sense of safety and emotional stability, you know, like, comes from. And I found that's what I was doing. I was like, oh, like, I, and secretly, I don't know how many people knew that, but I found that I was feeling hurt or isolated or rejected in ways that years later I came to realize, like, oh, that person wasn't doing it. That situation wasn't doing that at all. That was me in how I was feeling and what I was projecting into here because I had this deep sense of safety that I had found on sets because my home life was fucking crazy.
And Chris, given that you went through that, and as you mentioned, we've had other guests on the show that have gone through something similar. And as you alluded to, we'll have future guests that have will share with us that they've gone through something similar as well. Do you have any opinions on how that might get addressed up front so less people have to deal with what you dealt with?
It's hard. It's a really hard thing. I don't know if there are like barriers that you can put in place to rid anyone of that experience. I mean, that's why I talk about it now is like, you know, God forbid there's like a current kid actor listening to this podcast trying to figure out like how to do stuff. But I don't know. I mean, I think, I don't know. I really don't. I mean, what I do know is this, you know, if there's any kid that I would share an experience with that's growing up or any adult that grew up with a childhood that was filled with trauma and filled with volatility and abuse, that you'll probably find this in some form. You know, you might find this in your relationships, or you might find this in your or in some form of relationship to teachers or to boyfriend, girlfriends or to other family members, who knows. So I don't know if it's something that's escapable, you know, in some way. What I do know is that maybe there is something to really calling out the entertainment industry for what it actually is, which is it's not the deeply personable, treat everybody how you would want to, your family and closest friends to treat each other. That's not the entertainment industry's fault.
That's people's projections of what they hope the entertainment industry to be.
Exactly. And so if there's anything to it, I think it's maybe skewing or putting in real good perspective what the entertainment industry actually is, you know, and to be honest, what it should be. You know, I mean, this is my opinion now. It's like, you know, the work life I understood, I was like, oh, right. Like you don't, you know, I'm sure if you're a doctor, you don't want your fellow doctors and nurses showing up with undealt with childhood trauma, trying to solve those things through the relationships that they have, you know, at work. You know, it's like, that's just not, you don't want that, you know.
Yeah, but I get your point.
Yeah. But the difference is when you're in the entertainment industry, you're doing these jobs that are emotional in nature, where you're exposing yourself, you're being open, and people are engaged with you and they're connecting with you on these deep, sometimes very spiritual levels, you know, or the stories that you're telling have the power to like move and change people's lives, or at least have this profound effect on people's lives. And they can literally touch like millions upon millions of lives through the television. Like there's a power in the entertainment industry that is significant, that does change the relationship people have to the job, you know? So it's, I don't know, it's strange and it's multifaceted and it's wild. I can just say for absolute fact, to cap off this whole sermon we've been given here, yeah,
not
just
we.
Me. I know. Thanks for bearing with it, AJ. But I feel passionate about it. I think it's something that, you know, I get to really explore.
Appreciate seeing you have an opinion, as I am with a lot of the child actor stuff and how we can help. This is your version of that. And I'm glad to hear you sharing a bit of it.
Yeah, good. AJ's going to rally some new union laws and some new state and congressional laws.
No, hey, this is your thing. Yeah,
I'm going to rally for therapy. That's what I'm going to rally for. Therapy across the board for everybody. Hey, everybody gets therapy. No, you get therapy. You get therapy. Everybody gets some therapy. That's the name of the game today, folks. Okay, you know what? We've spent a lot of time talking about childhood trauma and therapy and the pitfall. Remember the pitfall where former kid actors find themselves in as they turn into adults. So without further what, AJ?
Adieu. How was that?
That was great. Fantastic, right, guys? Okay, without further ado, our talk with Charlie Talbert. All right, we're here with our old bud, Charlie Talbert. Charlie, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yep, we appreciate it. So, Charlie, we're so excited to talk with you today, man. Out of all the kid actors we're talking to, you have a really unique start to your career as a kid. It's very different than most people we know. And, you know, you were basically plucked out of obscurity and then just thrust in to playing this protagonist of a big budget feature film opposite some really respected veteran actors. I think it was Kathy Bates and George C. Scott were in this movie with you, this movie called Angus. And so can you tell us a little bit about how that happened, how that went down?
So I was really into cycling when I was growing up, and we were I'm originally from Kenosha, Wisconsin, but just south of there is a place called Northbrook, Illinois, and they have a velodrome there, cycling velodrome. And we were coming home from that one night, like around midnight, And there's this oasis that hangs over the highway, and it's Lake Forest Oasis, Lake Forest, Illinois. And there's, I think it's a, yeah, there's a Wendy's, Mr. Dave Thomas, and then there's a 31 Flavors. And I'm standing there, and I see this girl that I go to school with, and I'm making her laugh. And it's pretty busy that night, just because this is a main section highway, and that's like the only oasis. And I'm telling her some joke, and I'm making her laugh, and all of a sudden everybody's laughing. I've got like, you know, a couple dozen people just giggling. And this guy comes up to me, pretty big dude, who is director. His name's Patrick Reed Johnson, and he rolls up to me, and he's like, hey, man, I'm wondering why it's taking me so long to get food, and I realize it's you. He's like, look, I'm a director. Would you like to be in a movie? And I just looked at him, and I was like, are you gay? And he goes, what? Why would you ask me that? I said, well, it's near Chicago. It's 12 o'clock at night. I'm wearing spandex, and I have titties, and you want me to be in a movie? What are your thoughts, you know?
What are you doing creeping around fast food restaurants at midnight asking people to be in movies? Yeah, I get that. It's a valid question.
Also, you just offended every Chicagoan, you know, insinuating that, like, you're by Chicago, maybe you're gay, like, you got a thing going on.
No, but I know they do a lot of filming there, you know, so it's just one of those things where, like, what are you filming where you're looking for, you know, a breasted young man who looks very thoughed in the face, and you know, you want me to be in a movie. I mean, hell, I have a hard time looking old now. Look at me, you know, and I'm 40 something, you know. So I was like, okay, yeah. Like, he's like, no, man, I directed the movie Space Invaders. Have you heard of it? I'm like, yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. He's like, well, man, I'd love for you to come, you know, meet and talk to me about this movie. Can you come down to Chicago, you know, later in the week on Wednesday, to this lady named Jane Alderman's casting office? She cast the movie Rudy. And I was like, oh, I know Rudy. He's like, I love that movie. And he's like, well, this is kind of like Rudy, you know? And I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. So I immediately tell everybody I'm with. We go back home, and I lived in a three-floor house. You know, we had basements in Wisconsin, and I would sleep in the basement because it's the best way to sneak out of the house, and it was the coolest place to be because you could sneak anybody in. So I come in, and I knock on the front door, you know, because my mom's sleeping in the main floor taking care of my grandma, and I'm like, Ma, I'm going to be in a movie. And she's like, shut the fuck up and go to bed. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, my hopes are dashed against the rock. I go to bed, and I spend the next few days trying to convince myself, or my mom, maybe myself, that this grown man is really making a movie, and he wants me to be in it, and it's legit, and nothing on me is going to be open that I don't want opened. And so I convince her, and we go down to Chicago, and we go to Planet Hollywood, which we had no clue what a Planet Hollywood was, you know? So we go in.
Wait, that's where the audition is? The audition is at Planet Hollywood?
Right, yeah. So
this is very sketchy.
Well, I don't know, but it's
this guy's at Wendy's, and he's like, "Hey, I need you to come to Planet Hollywood next week and sit with me in between Rocky's boxing gloves and Nick Cage's wig from Con Air, and have a have an audition out in a public restaurant." But you have no context, right? This is, you've never auditioned before. You don't know what they could have said. Hey, man, you got to come down to Vegas and sit at a craps table and have an audition. You wouldn't know any difference. You're like, all right.
I would have been like, what's a craps table? That sounds gross, you know? And so, yeah, so I go, and the office is above Planet Hollywood. So it's like one of those old school buildings, but the first floor has been converted, you know?
I see.
And so I go, and I go upstairs, and I see these extra wide chairs, and I'm thinking, oh, fat people chairs, they're expecting me. So I sit down, and then I see this dude leave that kind of looks like a carbon copy of me. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, this is the right place. They're looking for fat kids like me. So I roll into this room. The door opens, you know, I hear somebody say, come on in. The door opens, and it is about the creepiest room you've seen in your childhood ever. It's dark, it's ominous, it's like a library from a murder mystery. Cherry oak desk with the, like, you know, green, like, you know, place setter replacement thing so things don't move, desk set. And he goes, yeah, go over to your mark. And I'm like, who's Mark? And he's like, no, the light. And I was like, okay, so I got a light. And he's not looking at me. He's like looking at something. I don't know if he's making notes on Alaskan or whatever he's doing. And he's just kind of looking down. And he's like, okay, we're going to do scene one from your sides. And I'm like, what the fuck's a sides? You know, and he looks up at me like, who the hell just said that? This, you know, and he realizes, he goes, oh my God, you're the kid. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a kid. You know, and he's like, no, you're the kid that I met at Wendy's. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, oh, sides are like little scripts, you know, that you read. I was like, oh, okay. It was like, I don't have that. You didn't send me that. And he's like,
you just told me Planet Hollywood, and now I'm here. That's all I know.
I'm going to a magical place that I've never heard of called Planet Hollywood. It's got to be real, you know? So, you know, I eat the candy, I get in the back of the van, and I help him find his dog, you know. I'm like, okay, well, he goes, well, like, have you done any, like, plays? Do you do any comedy? What do you do? I said, well, I do, like, some impersonations. And he's like, well, who do you do? I go, I do, like, Elvis and Jim Morrison and Goofy, you know. And he's like, really, do your Elvis. So I did my Elvis, you know. And funny story, side story, I've done 27 weddings and 13 of them dressed as Elvis. I love doing weddings. So, you know, back to me, and I'm like, he's like, well, what's your Jim Morrison? And I go, check it out. So I turn around and I go right into the corner and I point my face in the corner and I start singing, you know, and he's like, that was pretty clever. I was like, oh, thanks, man. And he goes, well, look, man, why don't you come back next week? You'll come meet with Jay and I won't be here. And in my head, I'm thinking, well, there goes that. You know, the one guy that liked me and had faith in me will not be here. And I have to come back and, you know, work with this woman who I still really haven't met. And I actually saw her. I haven't mentioned this, but I saw her as I was leaving. And, you know, she was an older woman. And it was like, I got to come back. And I got to impress this person. And for some reason, the shadows on her, she was like in her kitchenette or whatever the thing was in the casting office. And it was really scary. So that made me all the more like, oh, my God. So I tell Mom how it went. And I was like, I got to come back. I have something to call a callback. And she's like, okay. So we went back home and I studied. And I sat in a rocker very much like the one I'm in right now, because that's my thing. And I sat and I learned these like six scenes that I had to learn, like this huge speech and all this stuff. And I'm like, I gotta learn. So I'm practicing left and right. And we go back and I do the audition. And then I get a call, you know, a couple weeks later, and it's Patrick, and goes, hey man, we'd really like to fly you down here to LA and put you up in Santa Monica, and we'll give you some money to hang out. We'll pick you up from the airport, you and your mom, and you'll hang out for a day or so, and then we'll do the audition process. And I was like, cool, cool. So they put us up in a really nice Radisson Hotel right off of 3rd Street, and it overlooks Santa Monica Pier. And one of the scenes I had to do is with a blow-up doll called Wanda, who sat in my living room, by the way, for many, many years after the movie. My grandma had a lot of love for me, and so she knew what it was. And so I go and I win one of these like blow-up dumbbells, and that becomes my Wanda for the audition, you know? So I go into the audition the next day, the office building, they pick me up, and I walk in and I see who would later, you know, become the awesome friend I know as Ethan Suplee. And then I'm walking and then I see Whoopi Goldberg, and I'm like, that's Whoopi Goldberg, comic relief. And I'm talking to no one because I'm
She's just walking by casually doing something else in life, or she's auditioning
she had
for...
come out of the casting office. Oh, so she had come out of the casting office. So long story short, I was just like, okay, this is cool. I go into the room and I sit down, and then they bring this kid in, Chris Owen from Major Payne at the time, but I didn't really know that. And you know, from American Pie. Yeah. So he comes in and they sit us down. There's this camera, and it's set up with the camera, and it's a nice lit up professional room. And I'm like, okay, cool. So they're like, hey, you guys hang out in here for a minute. We'll be right back. We'll do some scenes. So Chris and I just, you know, we're trading stories about how we got there. And he's like, oh, wow, you telling a joke? I was like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, you know, I just did a movie and stuff. I was like, cool. And we started finishing each other's jokes. And we became instant best friends. He's still my best friend to this day. He just got married actually last week. So they come back into the room and they're like, hey, listen, it's like 15 minutes. They're like, we're not going to do any audition stuff today. Can we, you mind if we send you guys to Disneyland, give you a couple $100, see if you guys get along? And I just look up at him and I look at Chris and I go, who the fuck's not going to get along in the happiest place on earth with $200 in their pocket? And, you know, I'm a welfare kid. I'm like, this is great, you know. So Chris and I go. We have a great time. It's me, my chaperone, and then Chris and his dad. And we just have a killer time. We come back, I think it's a couple days later, and we're sitting in the room. And then they bring James Vanderbeek. What we didn't know, by the way, on that first thing was they were all in the other room watching us on a monitor because they turned the camera on. That's why they knew we were getting along so well. So they wanted to see if we really got along.
Creepy. It's like an FBI interrogation scene. They're like, there's a mirror and you guys just think you're alone and they're actually watching you.
Right. So I'm the kid in the back of the
Were they watching you go to Disneyland too? Maybe, yeah, maybe to this day, you just got no idea.
Right, right. And you know, the casting director is Ronnie Eskel and her assistant, which is, her casting associate, which is Richard Hicks. Awesome. And they bring in James Vanderbeek. And we're not clicking like Chris and I did. Chris and him are not clicking, like, you know, it's just not happening. But there's still kind of a camaraderie there. And they sense that. We went through our scenes. I go home, back to Wisconsin. A few weeks later, I get a call from Patrick. And he's like, dude, I think, you know, I'm sorry. You know, I appreciate you coming out. And we really wanted to work with you on this. And I was just like, I understand. Nothing good happens to a kid from Wisconsin. And he's like, how do you feel about spending 3 months with us? And I was like, what? He's like, you got it, man. And I was like, damn it, yeah, you know. So that was the deal.
Man, that is a really wild story. There are so many twists and turns to that. And there's so many questions I know we have for you, not just about that. But as you were talking, I was thinking, I am so curious how that type of event, how that really unexpected, unpredictable event affects your life, not just then in that time period, but as time goes by. You know, you're like, nothing good ever happens for a kid from Wisconsin. So, like, what was your life like at that time? And, what, you know, who were your parents? Where'd you go to school? What were you doing? Like, what were you doing besides just hanging out at Wendy's? Or was that all you were doing?
Well, man, I got to tell you, my life growing up, it wasn't particularly easy. My mom shot my dad in front of me when I was 8 years old on accident. He died in my arms. It was tough.
Oh, I didn't know that, man.
And no, but it happens. Yeah. You know, things happen. I saw this. I had to reenact it. All kinds of weird shit happened with my childhood. I was also fat, so I got picked on a bunch. I was in love with the same girl from kindergarten to 12th grade. We're really good friends now. She's also married to a guy named Charlie that could be my brother. So I win.
Weird.
She's happy. I'm happy.
Was that the girl at Wendy's or a different girl?
No, this was just a girl from high school that I knew. You know, she was always like super, super nice to me. I mean, I could tell you what she wore on the first day of kindergarten, you know, and like straight down to the little two different color hair clips. So it was one of those things where it was like a whole new turning point where when that happened, I didn't have to not know what my future was. I wasn't uncertain about what direction I was going at home because I didn't want to be at home. I wanted to go do something. And I was always a wiseacre. I did plays in school and stuff like that. And I would sleep in the auditorium of every school that I went to the night before I went to a play because I was always friends with the janitor. I grew up in my grandma's house after my mom shot my dad. I had to live with my grandma for a while. And I pretty much stayed there until I graduated, but I didn't want to end up at home. I knew there was something different. I was always a wisecracker. I always liked to play. I always liked to be the center of attention. I always, like, took the elephant in the room, cut it open, and was like, look at the elephant, you know, and let's talk about why this is so awkward, you know. And I think it was because of all the trauma and stuff growing up. And my mom was pretty physical with me when I was growing up and stuff like that. So that was a weird thing. So I knew that I got to get away from that. And it gave me new confidence in school, new confidence with everything I was doing. And, you know, Angus, when it came out, was kind of a bust. It came out against, I think it was against Hackers and Bay Pig and the City was still out in the theaters at that time. But later on in life, it definitely, you know, it grew this huge following that I cannot explain. But it was pretty amazing. But I was also sad when the movie came out because they had cut out the gay fathers, played by Larry Drake and Robert Curtis Brown. They still kept Rita Moreno and Anna Thompson, but it was definitely, there was some mixed bag about the whole thing.
And so you just mentioned you were in school, you had done theater a bit. And so was that something that you were doing just as like an extracurricular fun thing, or were you taking it very serious? Like, what did that mean to you to be acting in general? Was it just, you just like being
the center of attention? It meant I got to not be home. I got to play, but I was pretty passionate. You know, the thing about the girl that I liked kindergarten through high school was I would write her poetry. And at one point in fifth grade, the teacher found one of the notes that I wrote to her. I remember it starting out something like, it's weird to be such a short blade of grass in a meadow, you know, of poppies. And I kind of wrote her this little like love letter, and my teacher found it, read it, started crying, calls me up to the front of the class and says, nobody will ever love you like this. And then gives the note to my counselor. My counselor calls my mom, and I told your mom was a little physical growing up. And like, I was a grown ass man. And the counselor calls my mom and says, do you know what kind of letters your son has been writing? My mom comes down to school, you know, bad Leroy Brown going, what the, did he say? What did he say? And the counselor's like, no, I wish my husband would write letters like this to me. This is beautiful. You know, he's got real talent and stuff. And
so you've,
it was just a way to escape.
I get you, yeah.
And be poetic.
And you've obviously got a very then, I mean, if you're writing poetry that's making adults cry in school, you know, there's a deep part of you that needs to express itself creatively. And, you know, and so you find theater, you find poetry and comedy and making people laugh. So that when this guy walks into Wendy's, then do you think that primes you to jump at this opportunity to go, oh my God, this is absolutely like, this is like a missing key in my life. This is, it wasn't like a weird, like,
yes,
I guess we'll go along with this. This, you jumped in passionately. You were like, oh, this is it.
It was great. The book in the addict. It was the book in the addict and never ending story for me. It was just like, what is this? What is this golden opportunity? Yeah. You know, like, yeah, you know, and I was just like, this is, I've got to jump on it. Because if anything, if this doesn't work out, I can just go to the next thing and bullshit. I'm kind of a streetwise guy growing up, you know, so I'd be like, you know, I probably would have went to Second City and be like, well, I had this drag see me up at Wendy's and he thought I was pretty awesome, so maybe you think I'm awesome. You know?
So like, did you were immediately able to recognize that as your way out, potentially?
Yeah. My family growing up, like, a lot of cousins, you know, Italian, this, that, you know, so all different attitudes. But I learned so many things from each of my cousins. The female cousins, you know, I learned how to be in touch with my feminine side, accept my bosoms and me. My, you know, my three Italian cousins, Mike, Carl and Jimmy, they taught me how to be like, you know, really self-confident. My cousin Mike gave me my sense of humor. You know, my cousin Ricky, he was my half-brother. I'll tell that story some other time. They would all protect me, but they would give me these little tidbits. So I knew that I could kind of hustle my way to the next thing and get out of town if I needed to.
So Charlie, your story of how acting started for you, being plucked out of obscurity, being flown to Los Angeles, going to Six Flags, getting the call that you're the movie. This is what I fantasized about. This is what I thought starting as an actor was going to be. Just like this, you know, despite the rough time you had growing up, this transition into, was it like going to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory? I mean, you literally stepped into a new world where seemingly everything is perfect and you are suddenly the center of attention for a huge movie, which is a big deal. I'm assuming you were number one on the call sheet walking into that. Just, I'm interested to know what that was like emotionally for you to go through that transition from where you were coming from to stepping onto set and this new reality that you walked into. Could you tell us a bit about that?
AJ, I'd like to answer that question in 37 different parts, if you don't mind. Okay, I'm going to tell you this. I didn't have a lot growing up. I was well provided for, especially with grandma having to take care of so many kids. But I didn't have a lot growing up. Like, everything I had was pretty much secondhand. Aldi's shopping was the best, you know, like, that's when you got your case of soda for the money. You know, all kinds of, that was the big treat, you know. But I never really wanted for anything. But I always wanted more. And when I got Angus, I was a bit of a cockhead. Like, you took Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Like, my desk, like, I took over the teacher's desk, filled it with Yoo-Hoos and candy. I was a little shithead. Just because it was so exciting. I did my job, you know, and I respected everybody that I was working with. But I was also so new to what it was, and I hadn't had that kind of luxury before. And I had a earth-shattering moment and an awakening when we were filming one of the scenes during Angus. And the sound guy let me put on the headphones, and he goes, God, you're such a little shithead. And he says this into the boom mic. He goes, you need to fucking, you know, stop acting up. Get your shit together. You're doing good work out there, but you're kind of a prick. And I was like, and I started crying, and I went out to him, and I'm like, dude, I'm so sorry. And I talked to him, and I said, this is heavy. You know, I'm like, you know, I don't want you to feel that way. I'm just so used to fending for myself. You know, and this is just like, everybody's a big family, so I just kind of think of you all as family, and I forget that there's boundaries when you meet new people. His name was Robert, and his boom man was Ken, and we ended up getting along after that. It was really cool, and that was really an eye-opening experience. But back home, it was definitely a juxtaposition of my life, and it, you know, I got to meet Georgie Scott almost immediately. He gets out of the car, and he goes, well, you must be Charlie, and I was just like, General Patton knows my name, you know? And then when I got to work with Kathy Bates, the first thing she did was this was in LA. We started in Minnesota and then we went to a soundstage in LA and I got to meet Kathy Bates. And by this point I had learned my lesson from, you know, from Robert. And he says, she says, look, I need to pick out the cover for this movie I just worked on. She tells me about the movie and she goes, these are the two covers and I have final say. Which one do you think I should go with? And she told me about it, and it was Dolores Claiborne. So I said, well, this is the cover I would want to go with for the story you just told me. And she said, done. She picked up the phone right then and there and called him and said, this is the cover we're going with. And that's how we bonded. And I started to learn, and Dawn Steele, who was the producer, Dawn Steele was, you know, head of Paramount for 5 years. She was actually the most powerful woman in Hollywood for many, many years. And she had taught me a lot of lessons along the way, things not to say, you know. At one point, something had happened, and I said, how am I going to get Jude out of doing that scene? And she goes, you said what now? And I said, Jude out of, and she goes, you know, I'm Jewish. And she explained to me, like, her heritage. And it was like a whole new world of culture for me that I was just like, wow, I have so much to learn. And definitely coming out of that movie, I learned a lot about myself and who I was, you know, and the things that I was doing. And I simmered down a bit. And it was really just kind of a shock to my system. It was one of the most awesome experiences for my life, and it happened at the right time for me, personally, I feel. So I don't know if that
answers. It does. I mean, in many ways, what you know, and correct me if I'm wrong in saying, it feels like up until that point, up until you get this audition and go out to LA and do this movie, you could be anything. You could be every part of you, anything you want, and there, you know, you didn't need to be anything else besides your teenage self. And then all of a sudden, not only are you given this really cool opportunity, but with that comes a responsibility and an expected maturity that suddenly is necessary. And it sounds like you got a lot of people that were willing to be honest with you and to give you their perspective and to help guide you a bit, which is really nice, it sounds, because I don't know if everybody gets that. I certainly always feel like I didn't get that. Every time I sort of feel like I misstepped in ways, people got silent, and I would find out later in some other weird way. I was like, oh, I don't think they like me, you know, and I'd have to deconstruct it all myself.
Right. Chris, the principal of photography on that movie was 4 months. So I was with this group of people for 4 months, and they saw me come in as an unexperienced actor. But you know what? There wasn't a day where I wasn't trying, where I wasn't feeling the scene. You know, we did the rehearsal for When Grandpa Dies. And true story, spoiler alert, 26 years later. After Grandpa dies, I go back to his friend in the park and who he plays chess with. That gentleman, by the way, is Irving Kirshner, who directed Empire Strikes Back. And I do the chess scene, and I'm just bawling during the rehearsals. And people knew that I really cared about what we were shooting, because it really was a real strong parallel to my life. So they saw the passion that I was giving, even if I couldn't see it, but I knew I was giving it. And they saw my interest in who they were too, but I was a little shithead. So these people that came in and like adjusted me and corrected me. When I left from principal photography, again, we did another 4 months of narration because the story changed so much, you know? And it was really like I left with a whole new family. You know, people that understood me, that trusted me, you know, including the actors, you know, and it was really something we were all proud of by the time we were done. So it was really kind of candid on set. We would all be really candid with each other as we got towards the middle of shooting and stuff like that. And it was really nice. And I was never afraid to ask for help. I was working with Larry Pressman, you know, from 9 to 5 and Doogie Howser and all that. I was really, like, I grew up watching Larry Pressman, and I knew who he was, and I was just like, I kept laughing during the scene, but it was because of the pressure of what was happening in the scene. This is where I'm confronted by the principal after James's character, Rick, is confronted me in the hallways. And I kept laughing, but I, you know, I could tell there was frustration in Larry's face, and I said, you know, Larry, how do I shake this? Because this is really bothering me and I can't kick it. It's not because something's funny. It's just because I'm overwhelmed with it. And he straight up stopped and was like straight into telling me what was going on and how to work it out. And right then and there, we kept going. You know, we missed like a little beat and we just kept the scene flowing. So there was a lot of that went on during production. I had problems when I had to cry. My grandpa sends me this plum tuxedo, and I open it up, and in the box it says don't open if you're Superman, because I have this, you know, he has a speech about Superman's not brave, and I open it up, and inside, because I couldn't cry, and Anna Thompson was getting upset because I don't think she understood that I wasn't a professional or a trained actor. And the director put a note inside that said, listen, we just got a call, your grandma died. And I started crying, and we did the scene, and we cut, and I put the box down, and I ran over, and I started punching the hell out of Patrick. And he was ready for it, and he knew, and then right after we hugged for like a super long time, and I said, thank you so much for pulling that out of me, because that's what needed to happen. And, you know, he was definitely a child actor's director. So there was a lot of that that went on. So a lot of things that changed my perspective.
That does sound like a lot. I have a few questions. I mean, it sounds like you not only were able to just show up and be you and allow that to be part of this movie and part of this character. And as you've said a couple times, that you related so much to Angus. But it sounds like you were able to sort of evolve with this process and learn how to discern between you just being you and also you needing to make like choices as an actor and act essentially as well. And also learn the process of perhaps when a director's manipulating you to to get something out of you that's necessary for the scene or for the character. And that's really interesting. I mean, as you look back at it, is it like an experience that gets better for you, or are there times where you kind of look back and you go, hey, fuck you, man. You didn't need to tell me my grandmother died. You know, it's like, does it always feel really cool and as majestic as it sounded as you were going through it? Or,
dude, I'll give you a really good example. I worked on HBO's Watchmen. I did episode 6, This Extraordinary Being. And the director had shown me some clips of the reveal for the storyline. And he was playing the Whiplash soundtrack over it. And I love nothing more than when a director or even a fellow actor will talk to me about what they're feeling or what they want to see. Because when I watch something, like if I tape myself for an audition, I'll watch it back and be like, would I watch that? And there was like a couple times here and there in my later teens where I was a little cockier in that respect, where I'd be like, no, I got it. But it was mainly because I had it. Like I had it, and I don't want to talk about it because I'll kill the moment. So I've become a bit more method. Like one of my really good friends, and I call him my spirit animal, was Ben Foster growing up. Ben Foster is definitely that embodiment of someone that takes it all into his soul. And it was one of those things where I see that in myself. I really go to that place before I work. I really, really deprive myself of something before I work. I you know, it's not full transformation like Jared Leto or something like that, but it's definitely that darker place or that happier place that I need to go to, because happy comes out of the darkness. You know, you can't do drama unless you're good at comedy, or vice versa. You can't do comedy unless you're good at drama. And people were always like, oh, he's the funny fat kid. Let's give him stuff. And I never had a neck. You know, I had to do auditions where I'd have to wear fishing wire, so I'd look fatter and I'd wear progression layer of clothes and stuff like that. And that was always like an overcome struggle. So I had to sell them on the emotions. And the next thing that had happened to me was a big thing that had happened was I booked a movie called The Mighty with Sharon Stone and Jenna Rollins and Harry Dean Stanton as one of the leads. And there was another actor who was selected to play the disabled, you know, lead. And I was to be his friend. And he didn't quite mesh, so they pulled him. And then the kid that they got, which Kieran Culkin, we looked too much alike. And they ended up leaving me in a hotel room for 2 or 3 weeks without telling me I had lost the part. I had lost a scholarship in high school. ROTC, JROTC gave me a scholarship if I were to, you know, join JROTC and do their program, because it was the first time they were going to have it at Ruther Central in Kenosha. And they paid for my first year of college. So I left. I went to a strip club.
Wait, hold on. Chris's hold on for a second, went to there's a strip so club. Much. Wait, there's so much here that I'm trying to keep track of in some way. And maybe before, I want to revisit a couple of those things, but before we do, so just tell me first, like, to bridge a lot of that from you coming off of doing Angus and filming Angus, what is your life like when the dust settles? When you're done filming, do you go back to Wisconsin, or do you stay in Santa Monica and you and Chris Owens are at Disneyland all the time? Like, what does your life look like afterwards?
Well, when we were shooting Angus, for the most part, I stayed in the Oakwoods. the Oakwoods next to
we're very familiar with the Oakwoods.
Yep.
So then we finish Angus, and we head back home, and I have to go to school.
Charlie, are you with your mom at Oakwood?
I'm with my aunt. I did not bring my mom because I told you that we butt heads.
Right. So your aunt comes with you.
And my aunt comes with me, and which was turned out to be a huge mistake anyways. That's another story. She steals all the chairs from Angus, the George C. Scott's chair, Kathy Bates' chair, my chair, Chris's chair, and they blame me. They thought I stole them. You know, we did a press junket in New York one night. But long story short, so I go home, and I'm feeling a little bit better about what just happened. And I'm going to the school that's now 9 miles away instead of a school that's literally 4 blocks away because the girl that I'm in love with from kindergarten to 12th grade goes to this school. So I got to walk a few miles to my cousins, then drive with them to school. And, you know, I bought myself some clothes, gave my grandmother some money because, you know, she's always taking care of me. And, of course, I had money put away because I was a child actor and that's what they do at the time. And until you're 18. So life is pretty cool. People knew that I worked on the movie. People that were bullying me weren't so mean to me. But I definitely let them know that you were a dick and this is me now. You suck.
So you go back home. You go back home with this newfound confidence. You went and starred in this movie.
Right.
You learned how to be an actor. You learned that when you say something really hurtful and insensitive about someone being Jewish, that you can't do that. You learn like all kinds of things. And you've had all these unfathomable experiences probably to you just a year prior, and you go back to your town and you're just going to go back chasing that girl you're in love with and tell everybody else that they can go suck it because you're big time now.
I just wanted to ask, is this so hard to go from being the lead of a movie, living at Oakwood Apartments in sunny Los Angeles, back to Kenosha, Wisconsin, sleeping in your basement bedroom, living with your grandma? Like, is that, are you like, God damn it, I just want to stay in L.A. Why did I have to come back here? Or were you happy to go
home?
That
was the plan. No, the plan was to go back. But I was happy to go home. And to answer you, Chris, it was not much a suck it thing. It was more of a, this is what happens to the people that you pick on, man. Good things happen to them, and then they're not going to share that with you because you're a dick. And to answer your question, AJ, it's, When you're back there and everything's back to normal, I now had a newfound confidence that gave me tunnel vision to not only, you know, do all these new things in my community. Like I put money into the play that we did. We did Fame right after. I put like a few grand into that, you know, for a school play, you know, and because I wanted to just keep that creativeness going. And I was like, this is going to be the thing. I still knew it was going to be a driving force. And I knew one way or the other, I was going back to LA as soon as I graduated. You know, so there was a goal there. The girl that I was in love with, that was always just part of my core. I did have a little bit more ammo. And then later on, the first preview for Angus plays on Mortal Kombat. I'm at the Market Square Theater. I'm sitting there and I see the girl that I was digging right behind me, you know, like up in the next row, two rows back, next aisle. And she's got a couple friends with her that were always kind of like prissy to me. And they didn't really, you know, dig the fact that I like, you know, this girl. And I was like, I look back and I'm just like, okay, they're here. I'm nervous. She's here. She's in the room with me. And then Angus comes up on the screen and there I am like fucking 50 feet tall, you know, in my mind. And I immediately stand up and I looked at her evil friends and I go, ha! Not my proudest moment, but man, I felt great. I was like, that's it. I've accomplished everything I need to in life. I can die now.
I mean, this parallels, you know, so Angus in so many ways, hearing the story. I just watched Angus last night to refresh. And, I mean, there's so many of these moments are in the movie. It's wild.
Did you watch it on HBO Max?
You're just living it out.
Yeah, it did.
You're just living it out.
And that's the thing. Angus always paralleled me. I think that's why it was so easy to really kind of fall into that and, you know, really adapt to that.
So now we're to the point, so you shoot the movie, which is an experience. You go home after having achieved this incredible thing, but yet your friends haven't had an opportunity to see it. So what happens in life after the movie comes out and now you are a bona fide movie star? I mean, you're the title role of a feature film. What's going on in life at that point when the movie drops?
Well, when the movie drops, I have to go out and do a promotion in New York. And we were supposed to go overseas, But because my aunt stole the back of the chairs, they thought I was going to steal stuff or something.
And your mom, wait, sorry, your aunt stole that stuff because she's never been on a set. And oh my God, that's absolutely incredible. And look at this. I mean, I by the way, I totally relate to that. My mom is a small town Jersey girl with a lot of issues and a wonderful woman. But she, I took her once to the first biggest movie premiere I'd ever been to. And they had all this like swag on all the tables where everybody's eating. And by the end of the night, my mom was like, here, you got to hold these six bags. I was like, six bags? And she had stole all the swag bags from all over the place. So I totally get, and I get when that's your family member. What that, you know, when you understand how that reflects upon you, you know, oh, you didn't.
But I didn't know. And I didn't know that she stole this stuff and two VCRs from the Oakwoods. Oh, no. I didn't know this until like 2.5 years ago, man.
So you did.
When her son calls me up and says, Charlie. And I go, yeah, what's up? He goes, I just found this box with two VCRs and like the Angus chair backs. And I'm like, what? You know, so I immediately get that stuff from him. I except for the VCRs, I was like, keep them. There's nothing I can do about it now. But I took the backs of the chairs. I sent the back of the chair for George C. Scott to Chuck Roven, you know, who does the DC stuff. He was a producer on the film as well. So I sent it to him with a note explaining what had happened with my aunt and how she had gotten vertigo afterwards and didn't really remember to tell me that she'd stole all this stuff. And she said, you know, so I sent that out, and then I sent Kathy Bates to her PR person, and I sent Chris's for his birthday, and I finally got mine, and I was just like, this is, I was like full of tears. But yeah, so I didn't know. I just felt like I was being blamed for something. So I'm in New York. I'm staying at
the Madison Hotel. Wait, real fast, you send all these chair backs to people 20-some odd years later. Does anybody say thank you or, oh my God, I'm so glad you're not a thief, or do they just... Or nothing? Like what happens?
No. Well, Chuck Roven, that's a different thing because it's not going to the person that belonged to it. Kathy Bates, people were really, really excited that they were getting that. Chris was really super happy, and he was like me because, again, Chris and I lived together for like 14 years at one point. We've done a lot of projects together. And he was just like, holy shit. I'm like, I know! Like what the hell? You know, like, such a different, like, my life could have been way different. You know, and so just because of this one little thing, and true story, I've never been overseas. You know, I've never been overseas, and that was the first.
Well, how did you know? How did you know they didn't? If you didn't know that they were even stolen 2.5 years ago, how did you find out?
The producers told me that they blamed me for all that, and that's why I ended up not going. Hmm. Yeah, so it was like I was like, and I totally understand that it wasn't me. I didn't do it, but how are you gonna know? Because I would be the only one that would be in the place to steal VCRs and take these, like, whatever. I'm like, I just made, like, a shitload of money for some kid from Wisconsin. Why would I steal? I bought a 3DO, for Christ's sake. What am I going to steal? You know, because I made the smart purchase. But, you know, in the gaming industry. Real visionary. But and then we went to New York. We did this thing. My mom ended up spending the night with Richard Simmons, which I didn't think was a thing, but apparently it's a thing.
Wait, what? What is that?
Yeah, so the night that we went out to New York, we did like a bunch of cities tours for this, me, James, we went to go see Les Miserables and all that stuff, and we went there, we had to go do an interview, and then we were going to see Les Mis, and he was on his way to go to, Richard Simmons was on his way to go to the Letterman show, and if you look up the Letterman show from like 1995, you'll see him in this multicolored vest. That's the night that my mom and him met afterwards somehow. And she spent the night in his room, and I was like, I didn't think that Richard's... But okay, but long story short, she comes out at like 4:30 in the morning, and we're all kind of saying goodnight to each other because we had this crazy night, and I was just like, so that happened. And then like for a few years after Richard Simmons, or months after, we'd received calls at the house from Richard Simmons' office, and I'm like, why is Richard Simmons calling?
This gets really wild. Like you're just trying to order a cheeseburger at Wendy's, and then there comes a point where your mom's at least hanging out behind closed doors in Richard Simmons' room. So your life gets, I mean, this whole thing really spawns off into a strange world, you know. And as I know you now, you know, you've always been, ever since Angus, you have been a dedicated, committed actor, so it obviously, this solidified that for you. You got the bug and you said, I'm graduating, I'm going back to LA, I'm going to be an actor, and I want to be an actor for the rest of my life, or, you know, for as long as I can. And so that happened. So walk us through that. Like, was that an easy decision, or did, you know?
So a week after, a week before school ends, my grandmother gets a phone call. This is 1997, senior year, high school. A week before school ends, my grandma gets a phone call. And she says, "Hey, this girl called from you." And I come home from the library, and she goes, "This girl called from San Jose to talk to you, named Lisa." And I'm like, "Okay." So I call the number back. I'm like, "Oh, it's something from California. It might be a job. I don't know." So I call the number, and it turns out she had her friend, who they call Internet Shelly, because only one friend back in the day would have had internet and know how to use it, found my grandmother's number from all these different articles. You know, found her name, tracked down her number. There was another Charlie Talbert that lived in my hometown, and they called that person. And then she was like, "Hey, look, I'm like 10 years older than you, whatever, and I want you to, you know, I want to meet you. I saw Angus on a preview for Don Juan DeMarco, and then I watched, you know, I'm a huge fan of yours. I think you're really cute, really sexy." We talked for a few weeks, and then I told my grandma, I was like, "I'll be back in a couple weeks," and I flew out to L.A., and then Chris's dad drove me up to San Jose to meet this girl. I was with her for about 2.5 years. Yeah, it was definitely, it was weirdness, because I had been jaded by, I'd lost that scholarship for not doing the Mighty because they went with a different look, but they decided not to tell me. And I found that out because I decided to take Chris's dad's car to a strip club because I was, you know, 18. I could go to a strip club. So I went to the strip club. And on the way out, I run into the producer, and the producer is just like, "Give me your manager's number now. I want your manager's number now." I was like, "Okay." So, and I'd been sitting in this hotel room after all this practicing and meeting Vincent D'Onofrio and James Gandolfini to play my dad and all these people, and Jenna Rollins and the stuff, and Harry Dean Stanton. And they get a call, and they're like, "Look, they went a different way." And my manager at the time, Beverly Strong, who is still my manager to this day, goes, "Well, we have a pay or play contract." And she had a business partner at the time, and the business partner goes, "Oh, I didn't get that in writing. It's only verbal." So we had to sue Miramax. I won because they ruined my scholarship and didn't send me home in time to recoup.
That gets really dramatic, really quick.
It was tough.
There's also another gap here, though, too, I don't want to skip over. So you finish Angus, the movie comes out. Are agents and managers calling you, Charlie, at this point? And somebody signs you? Or, like, at a certain point, you become a bona fide actor with representation after Angus, right? Before The Mighty.
Yes. It's actually during Angus. Oh, okay. Chris had introduced me to his manager, Beverly Strong. And, you know, Beverly represented Shane West and Rachel Lee Cook and Gabrielle Union. And I can't remember if she represented Aaron Paul. But you know, at one point, Chris and Aaron Paul, and Shane West, I mean, we've all lived in, like, Beverly's back house for one night or months, you know, you name it, but Chris lived around a corner from her. So we introduced each other, they signed me right away. I was given an agent in the very beginning to work out the deal at Goddess Agency in Chicago, but that was just for that project, just to work out the deal. And they signed me right away, and then I was picked up by Gersh. And then when I lost The Mighty, we had to let Gersh go because...
Wow. So I have to ask you, so at this point, and just tell us quickly, like, you know, you come off this being the star of a big budget feature, your life obviously changes in so many ways, and then as you decide, "I'm going to really enter Hollywood now. This is not now like just some chance encounter at Wendy's. I'm going to move to LA. I'm going to be an actor. You've got representation." All these things start to fall in place. You're making these conscious decisions, and that results in a lawsuit and being dragged, you know, along and not told that you're being recast and losing a scholarship and now proceedings with lawyers, I'm sure, and this whole thing. Do you decide, "Oh man, screw this, I'm out. This is not at all what I wanted," or?
I immediately went and I booked the main bully on a show for TGIF on ABC, which was Teen Angel. I book the part, we do the first day in front of the studio heads, and they let me go because they wanted to go with a chiseled dude that was like, the guy looked like Superman that they ended up getting, and then they replaced one of the leads with Mike Damas. And
so you just keep booking parts and then keep getting let go from parts right off the bat.
So I went out, I bought a gun, I went to Solly's on Van Nuys Boulevard, and which was only like a block from where Chris and I lived off of Addison. And that was it. I was just going to fucking go for it. Just, that's the end of it. And I'm sitting there in the booth. I've got the gun. I've got the bullet. It cost me $380. And this dude rolls up, and it's Blake Soper, who's the other half of Rilo Kiley. He was on a lot of kid shows growing up, including Wonder Years. And we had done my second movie, which I didn't really have to audition for. It was a movie we did with Scott Kahn called The Last Resort. And we really, really hit it off. And he shows up randomly at Sully's. It's around, 11 o'clock or something at night. And he's with a buddy. And he looks over and he's like, oh, hey, Charlie. I'm like, oh, hey, man. And I'm really dark on myself right now because this is one project after the other, And I'm just like, okay, this is tough. And he's like, look, my sister has injured her eye. I got to go to San Diego, like, right now. I need a road buddy. You down? And I'm like, yeah. So I took the bullet out of the gun. I left the gun in the chair, and I got in the car and drove down to San Diego and spent the weekend with Blake Soper. And then years later, my buddy Todd Giebenhain said, hey, I want to go check out this band, Riley Kiley. And there was Blake. And when we were done, it was a weird thing to go lay on him. But I told him, thanks for saving my life, And that was about the darkest I ever got in that.
I'm really glad you got in the road trip. That's really wonderful.
Yeah.
But I have a question immediately for that. So, you obviously, Angus was your ticket out. It was your ticket out of your life in many ways. And then you come here to fulfill that destiny that suddenly you were given. And it's, what's the word? Challenging and shitty. I don't know what the word. Yeah,
Bumpy?
Yeah, exactly. Bumpy. And it puts you there immediately. I mean, it puts you in a place where you're thinking about committing suicide. I mean, that's really. Can I ask you, when you talked to us about your experience with Angus, you had people that seemed to rally around you and were able to help you and mold you and shape you. Did it. In this time, were you just suddenly now just left to fend for yourself? I know you had your manager and you had Chris Owens, but do all those people, I guess maybe my best question is, what was your relationship with that director who comes up to you at Wendy's? Was he still around in your life at this point? Is he still to this day?
He's still to this day. We're still really good friends. We've talked about a series perhaps for this follow-up of Angus and stuff like that. And I went up and when I first moved to New Orleans, which is actually six years ago tomorrow, I drove up to Wisconsin to help him finish this movie he's been working on that I helped him do some of the first shots in 2007. And it's based on the first day that Star Wars came out, called 52577. And he was the first fan to see it. So we have that bond, which will never go away. He put me in this weird, strange, wacky ass world, and he'll reply to some of my posts when something awesome happened. He goes, I'm sorry, I did this to you, But we talk on the phone, we keep in touch with the fans, we sign posters for them simultaneously, and we send them off to the fans and stuff like that, and we talk about our ideas and our thoughts and processes. So he's a really good buddy. And then Chris's dad was kind of like a surrogate pop to mine, to me. My mom really wasn't street or book smart or anything like that, so I had to rely on Chris and his dad. They kept me alive for a long time, roof over my head, food, stuff like that. And thankfully, that suicide thing, I don't know what would have come of it, but...
Because you were brought there in such a short amount of time, moving to L.A., has that event, is that director walking up to you at Wendy's, did you attribute that feeling and that experience to that? Was there ever a point where you were like... Dude, I wish that didn't happen. Let me buy my burger and go on with my life. Or do you think it's always been as meaningful as it sounds like it has been for you?
It's always been meaningful. It sucked. I mean, business. Rejection's a bitch. You and I were up for Just Friends for the same role. Just you and I, back and forth for, a little bit of time. You never know. And it's crazy. But when I look at hindsight stuff, you were the perfect person for that. And then when I looked at The Mighty, when they got Eldon Hansen for the role and then Kieran Culkin filled in and replaced the other kid, I was like, this is brilliant. This is good. This is what I want to watch. And that's the thing, man. That's what I love so much about this business. Let me go 70s style, hippie on you. But that's the thing, man, is if I can make you cry or I can make you laugh or I can make you express something that you need to express when you're not in that mood, just because you watched a film I did or you saw Teenage Bounty Hunters and you see me, do this silly stuff and you're like, God, he's really, that makes me feel good about life. Because I get to do this, because I get to make you express those emotions and cry when you need to cry or laugh when you need to laugh, I'm never going to regret that moment that he came up to me and pissed off he couldn't get his food. Even when I go, God, I hate this rejection, or, oh, I hate this, or, I really booked the room, but this person didn't like me. It's not about that. It's because these little things I get to do that people did for me. And I do that. I keep a little tally of people that I loved growing up. Like, I've worked with most of the cast of SCTV. I've worked with a lot of the guys from Animal House. I've worked with, you know, a lot of the people from, you know, like SNL and stuff like that. These people that got me through my world and got me through that hard time with my mom and my life, I get to do this for other people. And sometimes I get to work with those awesome people that did it for me. You know, I nicest thing ever said to me was, man, I got to tell you, Dave Thomas looks at me, and he was with Eugene Levy, and we were standing around, and he goes, I got to tell you, you remind me a lot of John Candy. And I cried, and I got to play Farley's, and his brother had a show, Kevin had a show before Farley died, and Farley and I got to get up in front of the audience and do his moves and be crazy, and I actually own the jacket from Beverly Hills Ninja that Greg Nicotero made for Chris Farley, the Tiger one, and I've worn it in like 3 films now. And it's just one of those things where these little things that you get to touch the memories and you get to be part of that history and still reach out to people, never going to regret that.
Well, dude, I am so glad, man, you've been able to bounce back from such turmoil and such, you know, such intensely traumatizing experiences as you first come into being an actor. And, you know, and obviously Angus has been a part of your life ever since. And I, you know, my guess is you won't escape it. And so I'm glad that you, though, and Chris Owens and the writer-director of that movie have all remained close and have been able to, you know, always look back at that whole experience fondly, and it's never become anything other than what sounds like a really cool, really deep experience for you, and I imagine for them too. And so, to sort of bring us, you know, now we like to ask everybody that comes on the show a couple questions, and we like to ask, if you had a kid yourself, you know, and your kid's hanging out at Wendy's and someone walks up to them and says, hey, someone wants me to audition for a movie, what do you tell them? Do you say yes? Do you say no? What happens if you have a kid and they want to be an actor? Yeah.
Then we're doing it, man. Who are they? I'm going with you, but we're doing it. Yeah. You know, and then go do your thing. Yeah. I'm not going to be a set dad. You know, you go do your thing. You take whoever you want, as long as, like, I trust them. If you don't want to go with me, cool. Go, man. You got to take these opportunities. You just have to. There's so many amazing things. There's been a lot of crappy things that have happened to me, but I got to tell you, the balance between the two, amazing is across the board outweighing all the stuff that sucks.
And then AJ, and our last question.
Charlie, yeah, so the title of the podcast is The Coogan Chronicles, and you alluded to this earlier. So when you're a kid actor, 15% of everything you make goes into a Coogan account. What the heck did you do with your Coogan account money, Charlie?
Look, man, I'm really into coloring books and color forms. And I'm trying to think what I did. I basically just lived, you know. I took that money. I never bought anything extravagant or anything. You know, I took care of my grandma when I could take care of her, sent her money, and I just lived my life. I've been pretty independent from high school. Like, I've been on my own since high school and pretty much through high school. It was pretty much fend for yourself. So I just kept me alive, and I kept doing my thing and getting to the next step and getting to the next step. And when I didn't have money, my buddy Chris, you know, Chris Owen, he was doing really well with the American Pie movies. I remember him coming and saying, like, dude, I don't know if I want to do this East Great Falls thing. And both me and his dad were like, dude, yeah, you should probably do it. You know, it seems like a really good script, you know. And it was ultimately, he decided to do it, and that catapulted him. So when I suffered, he never let me suffer. You know, he always kept me afloat if I needed it. And he really helped me out through the rough times, but we would always work together on our auditions. We'd always want to work together. I think we've done like 12. I just created a new animated series that he just did a voice for us. So we're always trying to work together, you know. And the first thing I did when I got back into the business, because I quit for about 6 years, he came on board and played my brother, and we ended up zombies. And it was just really cool.
That's
stuff.
Cool, man. You know? I mean, AJ and I've always...
I took awesome. That money and wrote
That's
it.
Really,
you know?
Rad. Yeah, AJ and I have always talked about how what a nice benefit it's been. AJ and I also met as kid actors, and, you know, to have a lifelong pal, you know, that's not exactly what you think you're signing up for, but you can find it. And not every kid actor finds it. So it's nice that you and Chris have found each other. Well, dude, we really appreciate you being with us, man.
Yeah. Thanks, I mean, Charlie. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being so open, and thanks so much for all the amazing stories. And we're really, really excited you were here today.
This has been the most open.
We appreciate it, man.
Yeah, man, it's really awesome. And yeah, and it seems like such a simple, probably from the outside, an experience that you can just, I don't know, you feel like you'd probably assume you'd know everything about it. And everything you told us today is mind blowing to me. I would have no idea, you know? So I'm really appreciative of you talking to us today.
It's such an honor. I wouldn't trade any of it for a world. I'm going to do like small self plug here. I just worked with Bryan Cranston on his new show for Showtime. I did the Watchmen. I worked on Underground Railroad with Barry Jenkins, and all that wouldn't have been possible, you know, if it weren't for all these moments that make us who we are, you know. And I've always, you know, admired you, Chris. So it's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, you know, I'm in the right place, doing the right thing at the right time, and obviously the right people.
Well, you hear it, folks. Nice. If you're at a Wendy's, be yourself, you know, even when you're ordering a burger. Never know what happens to your life.
Chat up the counter, girl, if you're at a Wendy's. You never know what could happen.
Well, thank you so much, Charlie. Really appreciate you, man.
Thanks, Ben.
Okay, guys, that's the end of our episode. I'm doing the outro today, just like I did the intro. I hope you all enjoyed it. It was really great that Charlie was willing to sit down and talk with us. He had such a different experience than many of the people that we've interviewed so far on the show, and it's great to get all of these different perspectives. So big thanks to Charlie for opening up and sitting down. Hope you all enjoyed it. If you did, you feel like sharing it with a friend, please do. Maybe you want to share it with your mom, like I always do. That would be great as well. Rate us, review us. And until next week, thanks for listening.